and healthcare system. And with that, we have certainly just did a webinar. We have a little tip sheet and a summary document on that healthcare resilience and the consideration aspects. So it's a little shorter for you to read, and a topic collection that Dr. Hick and Karina Solabrito put together on climate change. What I want you to know about climate change is that what we really are after now is any success stories that you, your organizations, any specific hospitals might have on what they're doing to address climate change and how they've overcome some of the challenges. And we know that the healthcare workforce, including yourself, has been stretched to the maximum in the last couple of years. But again, as we continue to forge on, if you get success stories or information that you think we need to know about climate change and how facilities are overcoming those challenges, please let us know and we will highlight those and make sure we do a quick speaker session series or experience from the field article, because we want to highlight the successes out there and particularly some of the work that you're helping coordinate. We also did a crisis standards of care during COVID summary of state actions. We got a very good response rate of, I think, around 84% of the states responded to this. So it just gives a sense, the gist of crisis standards of care and how much action was taking place at the state level. So please do continue to check that out. And then, we certainly want to make sure that you're aware that we have countries experiencing conflict. Well, we did a landing page on healthcare preparedness and response resources for the Ukraine and other surrounding neighborhood countries. I think we're at about 1,500 downloads of that document from the landing page since we created it. So again, check it out. And if you have information that you think is valuable, please always continue to send that to us. And then again, on select webinars, I think we've done a lot of different aspects here. And if anything piques your interest, please check out the webinar. But if you have questions, please let us know. And we're happy to condense it down for you if you have something specific that you're trying to get to on any of the resources that we've developed since January 22. Next slide. And as Dr. Hunt said, we're trying to give you just a little bit of an inkling of what's coming next. I think it's going to be very interesting for you. The first two on the mock lessons learned. We have been able to canvas, I think, about 10 states who deployed mock concepts. And so we'll be summarizing that in a document and highlighting, again, some of the challenges, how they overcame those challenges, and some of the successes. And I think Dr. Hunt and with the new capabilities and the entire NHPP staff will be focusing on load balancing for patients and different aspects like that in the months to come. So I think this is a good base document to be able to see, again, how some state areas have overcome challenges and used the mock concept to get patients to the right care at the right level as expeditiously as possible. I also want to just point out that we do have a disaster available supplies for hospitals toolkit. It comes in the four flavors. The first two flavors, pharmacy and PPE. The pharmacy module is almost sort of done. We're having one last review by some really super pharmacy SMEs, and then we'll finalize that and deploy it along with the first draft of the PPE module. And again, what's the purpose of these? It's to help healthcare emergency managers within hospitals dialogue with like pharmacists and with their supply departments on what are the needed requirements for supplies and pharmaceuticals for different aspects of events. So check that out. And again, many of you will be on the distribution to review the draft of that PPE module that's coming out. If you don't know if you're on that list and you want to make sure you check out the draft PPE module, either email myself or ask Asper Tracy and we'll make sure you are on that grapevine. We're thinking about mid-May, the third week in May, we'll actually have that PPE module ready to review along with the final of the pharmacy module. We're also working on the next newsletter, Ethics in Healthcare During Disaster. And again, we're talking with several disaster clinicians across the country on how they dealt with the ethical dilemmas presented during COVID and how they overcame that and some lessons learned. And one thing I just want to point out that we heard from almost every disaster clinician that we talked to for these articles that we're putting into this next newsletter is how invaluable Dr. Hunt's Project Echo sessions were for disaster clinicians to be able to talk and bond and share experiences and stories with their fellow clinicians, not just nationally, but internationally. So I think I'll leave it there. We have a lot going on. Again, if you have any specific questions, reach out to us. And most importantly, thank you for what you do daily and your support of Ask for Tracy. Megan, back to you, ma'am.
Thank you so much, Shane. And we'll give a couple of minutes here. If anybody has any questions for Shane or the Ask for Tracy team, feel free to leave those in the chat or come off mute. We've also added to the chat a couple of links to the resources in addition to these slides that we will share after the webinar. But we'll give just a couple moments here for folks to ask any questions. All right. Well, seeing no questions, we'll just flag that feel free at any time to put those questions in the chat and we will make sure to answer them or get those answered and reach back out to you. But thank you again, Shane, for taking the time to share all of those and for curating all of these wonderful resources today. So thank you very much.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Of course. All right. So I will now go ahead and pass it over to Dave Cernak, who will introduce and moderate today's Hospital Association regional panel on load balancing. Dave?
Excellent. Thank you, Megan. And good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for joining us today. My name is Dave Cernak, and I am with NHPP. I'm one of the regional staff supervisors, as well as the field project officer for Region 10. And I am excited to be here with everyone today. Excited to be asked to help facilitate this, the first of what is hopefully going to be many monthly panels on the Hospital Association regional calls. So during each one of our monthly webinars moving forward, we're going to be asking healthcare representatives from one of the HHS regions. We're going to do our best to rotate throughout the entire country. We're going to participate in panel discussions highlighting hot topics and lessons learned throughout the COVID-19 pandemic. This month, we'll be healthcare representatives from across Region 10 are going to be discussing how their states handled patient load balancing and managed hospital capacity throughout the multiple COVID-19 surges. Next slide, please. It is my pleasure to be joined today by several representatives from across Region 10 to make some quick introductions here. From the state of Washington, I have Mr. Mark Taylor. He's the current director of operations for the Washington Medical Coordination Center based out of Harborview Medical Center in Seattle, Washington. From the state of Oregon, I have Daniel Davis, the senior director of patient flow from the St. Charles Medical Center, as well as also from Oregon, Dr. Carl Erickson, who's an associate professor of pediatrics, Division of Critical Care, School of Medicine at the Dornberger Children's Hospital, which is part of the Oregon Health Science University system. And last but not least, from the state of Idaho, I have Ms. Christine Newhoff, who's the senior vice president and chief legal officer at the St. Luke's Healthcare System out of Boise, Idaho. These individuals have volunteered today to join our discussion panel. They are all here to represent not only their healthcare systems, but they all played a key role in their local communities, in their local healthcare coalitions, as well as supporting the state and the respective states and Region 10 in managing the multiple COVID-19 surges. and assisting and supporting patient flow and patient management across the entire region. So we're excited to have them all on the call today, and we're looking forward to hearing about their individual experiences, their challenges, accomplishments, the way forward for each one of them. We are just, like I said, very happy to have them on board today. So without further ado, I'll start real quick with a couple of logistics for today's panels. So for each of the panelists, how this is going to work is I'm going to reach out with a discussion question, and then I will pick one of you at random to start the conversation. Then feel free to add on to anything a previous panelist has said. We'll kind of go around through the group. And then for everyone in the audience, right, feel free to insert any questions you have in the chat throughout the panel discussion. And then we're going to have a Q&A session following the discussion, in which turn we will turn to each of the panelists to answer any of the questions that you guys supply. So with that said, all right, without further ado, my first question for the group today is, it's going to focus on pre-pandemic, right? So could each of you tell us about what resources or capacity type systems your state had in place prior to the COVID-19 pandemic, specifically for managing hospital capacity and patient load balancing? So I'm going to start with Mr. Daniel Davis for this one. So over to you, sir.
Yeah, sure. Thank you, everybody. My name is Daniel Davis. My role is Senior Director of Patient Flow, as was mentioned earlier, in the St. Charles Health System in Central Oregon. When I think back, it's hard to think back about where we were pre-pandemic, given everything that's transpired over the last couple of years. But if I can get my head back around that, there really was limited resource available for our state. We have our daily reporting measures that happened that occurred in our HOSCAP system. So where we're situated within Oregon is directly on the east side of the Cascade Mountain Range, which can sometimes make it feel like there's a barrier, a physical barrier, as we move patients across that mountain path. So our St. Charles often feels like a bit of an island, and we're going it alone. So if we get ourselves in a position where we needed to move patients, our best resource at that time was the HOSCAP system. The challenge with that, though, was that it was a report that was as good as the information that was uploaded into it, and it was uploaded at best once a day. So we get ourselves halfway through a day and find ourselves in a difficult situation. We could use that as a resource, but as anybody that's involved in patient movement and capacity management knows, that's just a snapshot in time, and there's a lot that evolves. So it was a real challenge for us on the get-go as we started to run into any of these issues. There just wasn't a lot of real-time information available to us.
Well, thank you, Daniel. That's a good information. And actually, I'm going to look to Dr. Carl Erickson next, who's also from Oregon, but from a different part of the state. So your perspective, sir, on
Thank you. I totally agree. We had pretty rudimentary, honestly, in terms of any systems or processes to support this. I'm a pediatric intensivist, and for certain very limited resources, we had a little bit more awareness, I'd say. So the pediatric ICUs in the state, which are all concentrated in the Portland metro area, would communicate when capacity was limited to ensure that we at least had some statewide capacity. But that was a completely ad hoc system that was purely driven by medical directors to ensure that we were maintaining access. So no real system to support this work, certainly not at a statewide level.
Thank you, Dr. Harrison. Let's turn to Mr. Mark Taylor from the state of Washington. How are things in Washington?
Yeah, it's very similar. And I appreciate, Dan, your comment regarding the geographic barrier of the mountains. We share that similar experience here, and it does feel like almost an impenetrable wall in some circumstances. And I would say that our planning around patient movement also suffered from that geographic barrier. We do have our population centers are primarily focused around Puget Sound in Western Washington, with the other large center being Spokane on the other side of the mountains. However, near the two shall meet, really, when we talk about load balancing of any sorts across that mountain range. We also have in Washington State a similar program that we require highly suggest maybe a hospital's update twice a day. So every 12 hours, we get a sense of the current status and current capabilities of our, of the facilities in our state. But again, that's for actual real-time planning of patient movement. It's essentially completely unhelpful. The other thing I would add is that we have had, or we did have a fair amount of conversation regarding the local and state disaster medical coordination center group to be activated during MCI planning, which was some level of coordinated patient movement. However, other than really, I would say a couple of centers in Western Washington, two or three centers in Western Washington and the Spokane area, that local DMCC or Disaster Medical Coordination Center structure had not been exercised or to any great degree. And when you start talking about assembly of multi-regional movement beyond that, where we activated sort of an overarching state DMCC structure, that had not occurred. So we had some conversation about it, but really no active practice or execution on it.
Excellent, thank you, Mark. And Christine, your perspective from Idaho.
Well, I'd say our pre-pandemic resources sound like they're pretty consistent with both Oregon and Washington. I'd say we have a system for reporting in data on hospital resources, the Idaho Resource Tracking System. And we've evolved it so many times in the last 2 years that it's hard for me to recall what exactly it looked like pre-pandemic. But I would say one of the reasons we continue to evolve it over the course of the pandemic was discovering things that were less helpful because the way they were, the way the field was being either was being used or was intended to be used wasn't providing information that was quite as helpful as we thought we needed. So that resulted in changes over time. So the responsiveness was great, during these last 2 years. We also have a lot of geographic barriers in terms of the ability to move patients great distances. So that's not something that I would say happened with any degree of frequency. Nor was it needed with much frequency prior to the pandemic. And so I think we just had a lot of issues around patient movement that arose in the last 2 years that just had never really surfaced prior to the pandemic.
Excellent. Thank you very much. So it sounds like while there are several similarities across each of the states, pre-pandemic, there is definitely a lot of variation in some of the plans, processes, systems that were currently in place prior to the COVID pandemic response, which then potentially led to some challenges within each of your states. So my second question for the group is really going to start talking about these challenges as you began to identify them, recognize them, and began to strategize on how to overcome them. As each of your states started to experience these multiple reoccurring COVID surges, the hospitals began to experience challenges in bed availability, in workforce availability, in resource availability, et cetera, and their ability to not only identify available beds, available resources, and available transport assets. They were really struggling as well, I guess, to kind of communicate. But can you kind of expand a little bit more on these challenges that presented within each of your states surrounding the patient transport, patient load balancing, bed availability, and how you began to take steps to overcome these challenges as you began to experience these reoccurring surges? So for this question, I'll start with Mr. Taylor, Mark, up in Washington.
Yeah, happy to talk about that. We had, I guess, the unfortunate privilege of having kind of the first major outbreak of COVID occurring in a local local nursing home that sent a number of patients to an adjacent suburban hospital, not a small hospital, but suburban, that rapidly essentially overwhelmed that facility. And identifying that what was occurring there over the course of a very few days kind of led us to the immediate conclusion that we really needed to implore sort of that load balancing structure in order to be able to keep any of our local facilities, even though these are not small facilities within King County, the county that Seattle exists in. We need to be able to distribute patients more broadly to prevent a single facility from becoming overrun and running out of resources and having to start making exotic treatment decisions or rationing healthcare. So doing that, that DMCC structure that I referred to, we actually stood up our DMCC. This wasn't a mass casualty from a bus crash or a plane crash or a building falling, but this was in essence a single point of impact from with a large number of patients. And we distributed those patients to the broader King County region hospitals in order to accommodate those patient needs. That worked very well, but of course, it's a very kind of an off-label use of a structure that we had set up for an entirely different purpose. And the immediate recognition, I think, ranged from not only how we would identify resources to accomplish this on a long-term strategy regarding, care for something such as during the pandemic here, but also so that the facilities in and around our state had the knowledge of how to interact with some type of a coordination center to both recognize when they needed assistance, but also how they would provide assistance when they had those capabilities. So that became part of the structure, was this sort of education and training process that was needed for how to utilize a load balancing structure. And then I think the other kind of primary concern that immediately raised people's eyebrows was the ability to actually physically move the patients and how many transportation assets existed in order to accomplish that goal. That from in Washington State, again, Puget Sound metro area, highly populated, highly resourced, Spokane, same situation, lots of transportation assets, but 20 minutes outside of either of those areas and transportation assets immediately disappear. And it becomes very difficult to find and identify resources to move patients around. So accomplishing that, I think, was through a variety of also different, very creative uses of nurses from facilities, for instance, that may be able to ride along to provide enhanced care to patients during a transport, or a very low threshold for utilization of flight programs to move patients by air instead of by ground, even though it might be technically possible. There did seem to be capacity for air transport when we didn't have it for ground transport. So I guess that might be just some of the initial challenges that we faced as we started thinking about regional load balancing within Washington.
Excellent. Thank you, Mark. Appreciate it. I'm going to turn to Ms. Christine Newhoff now. So tell us a little bit about what types of challenges Idaho began to face and how you initially started to address those.
Sure. Well, our first experience with COVID in Idaho really started in a small hospital in a resort community, and that hospital became completely overwhelmed very quickly by not an enormous number of patients because it was a critical access hospital. And so we had to make some pretty fast decisions about how to handle the situation in that location, because not only, you know, did we have patients who had come in through the emergency department who had COVID and it wasn't immediately recognized because their initial presenting symptoms were GI, and that wasn't yet on the list of symptoms to be watching for in March of 2020. And so we not only had those patients, we ended up having many of our staff out with COVID, and ultimately and temporarily had to close that hospital and move all of the patients somewhere else. And so so that did present an initial challenge. Fortunately, we have multiple hospitals in that same system. It's the system that I work for, and we were able to transfer patients to another one of our facilities. And then that, you know, quickly ended up creating a significant, I'm going to use the word burden, but it's probably an overused word on the critical care resources at this other facility, and really had us thinking more about how would we as a state transport people if this were to be an outbreak at a more remote facility even than the one where it did start, or at a facility that didn't have sibling organizations who were standing ready and able to take on those patients. So I guess we did face that fairly early. And in terms of the transport needs, those initial needs we were able to handle, but we were concerned about what was going to be coming down the road in the future. And the state did initiate some statewide calls that included not just the health systems, of course, county emergency management, transportation agencies, and public health officials, statewide. It was a statewide incident command system that was set up early on in the pandemic and was meeting fairly frequently to talk about what resources were needed where and how could we redeploy those as needed. Our needs didn't reach a crisis level in those first few months, except in small, needs for transport, except in kind of more isolated instances. And those tended to be effectively addressed by county emergency management and transport services, as well as those that could be contributed by private entities who weren't as overwhelmed with patient surge. So some of the ones that aren't always first responders, but who are more typically transporting patients among facilities, were able to step up a little bit more in those circumstances.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Dr. Erickson, your perspective from the Portland metro area.
Yeah, thank you. So I'll start by saying that Oregon is among, I believe we may actually have the lowest number of hospital beds per capita in the union. I know we're certainly in the bottom five if we're not lowest. So that's a stressor, I think, even in some normal times. From my vantage point, we largely did okay through the early parts of the pandemic until the Delta surge. And we had, at that point, we started noticing, especially, so in the metro area where the majority of our sort of tertiary quaternary critical care service are concentrated, for example, all the ECMO in Oregon happens in the Portland metro area. We started noticing that the wait times were really increasing. People were calling saying, I've called 50 centers. You know, some of the stories I think everybody has heard about how limited access was. And that really spurred us to take action. I think another significant component was that what was often happening is people were calling 50 centers, and those 50 centers were all trying independently to get a patient in. So the amount of duplicate work that was happening was pretty staggering. And it's pretty deflating to, you know, spend a few hours trying to identify a plan for a patient, to call back to the referring center and find out that they got a bed assigned somewhere else 15 minutes earlier. Those were probably the major stressors that were really happening. We were fortunate in that we had a pretty good coordination between a lot of our hospital systems, both in the region and in the state. Some of that's because of our state trauma system and our regional resource hospital system. We essentially, Dan, I think it's fair to say we have six functional regions, probably, or maybe seven in the state, with the regional resource hospitals there meeting on a regular basis with our state public health leadership. We also had the CMOs of the major hospital systems in the Portland metro area meeting. And I think what was important about that was it established a way to communicate pretty quickly when things were not going well. What we set up in the metro area was initially basically just text messaging back and forth between the transfer centers of the major health systems. At first, it was the health systems that offered ECMO, and then it became the major health systems in the metro area. And we never tried to change transfer patterns for the majority of patients. We basically figured that anything that was working already, we weren't going to try to touch. It was really more based on an individual patient not being able to be served in a timely way. It was almost exclusively critical care. And at the beginning, it was really more tertiary, quaternary critical care. And the attempt was to basically present a patient generically to the group because of HIPAA constraints with text messaging. And anybody that could identify an appropriate bed within their health system would basically step up and say, I could take it. And then we would connect the referring to that hospital system. And it could be originated by any of the systems that were unable to place a patient in a timely manner. What we did subsequently was we expanded that to the rest of the state and to patients who didn't only need, you know, the ECMO kind of services, but who needed critical care services in general. I think we found that even in the middle of what felt to us very much like an emergency, people hold on to their usual patterns of behavior pretty frequently. So it's not uncommon at all for a specific hospital in Southern Oregon to call OHSU for just about every transfer need they have, regardless of whether it's a patient who really benefits from our unique services or whether it's a patient who could potentially be served elsewhere. And so the regional resource hospital system was a really great way to try to identify, often actually at closer hospitals, a place that had both the capability and the capacity to take care of the patient. I could talk about this for a long time, but I'm gonna break here and let Dan chime in with his perspective. And I'm sure there will be questions and other follow-up questions later.
Fantastic. Thanks, Dr. Erickson. And Daniel, your perspective, sir.
Yeah, I think Dr. Erickson just did a really great job describing kind of what was going on in the state and how we worked together. And it felt to me like when we did expand some of that coordination statewide, that was really where things started to, where we started to feel the ease. And so I referenced the mountain range as a barrier. It still was there, but it seemed to be less of a challenge and less of a barrier as we got into things a bit. I think at the very beginning, one of the things that helped us was that regional resource collaborative, where we were all getting on a call once a week or more frequently as needed, kind of scaled up and down depending on what was happening. But I think that became at least the forum for us to all start getting together and talking about what our challenges were. So as we all started to hit these peaks in capacity and recognition that there's more patients than we have beds across the state, and we have a lot of extra work happening as we're trying to find beds for these patients. That became the starting point. And I would give a lot of recognition and kudos to the OHSU team for the work they did within the Portland metro area to really establish a model that could be expanded for for the rest of the state. I think once we did expand the rest of the state, we kept it super simple. We tried to keep it as stripped down and as basic as we could. On the St. Charles, I think, and other regional resource hospitals identified a person and used their own personal cell phones and things to help coordinate. On the St. Charles side, we had an extra cell phone in one of our disaster boxes that we just pulled out and dedicated it for this purpose and left it with our administrator on duty to help coordinate. So 24/7, they were monitoring the phone, and our regional resource partners all had access to it. So we tried to keep it simple, and it was literally, hey, we've got an intubated COVID patient needing critical care, and we're at a critical care bed. Does anybody have it? And within minutes, we'd be getting responses from around the state. So I think the key in that too, where we got a lot more buy-in, was we started talking about some of the things Dr. Erickson already hit on, that we're not gonna disrupt normal transfer patterns. We want hospitals to continue that work, but we're gonna work together as regional resource hospitals to at least minimize the duplication of work and create some more situational awareness amongst ourselves, and then try to connect those within our region to where capacity might be. I think the other key was we really called out that we weren't going to serve as a transfer center for the state. We were really just a coordination hub together. And so we established that with our teams. And so there was never any, it didn't ever feel like we were competing. It felt like we were all pulling in the same direction. So I can cite several examples where we were at capacity and were able to quickly find a location for a patient. And we're on the receiving end of several of those too. As we work through, and I think about our partners down in the Medford area who seem to get hit the hardest at every single surge. They pulled patients when they had capacity too. So I think we were all able to set some of our own preconceived notions or agendas or even biases to the wayside and just work together as a team, I think probably out of necessity more than anything else. But I think the big thing we did was just kept it simple and tried not to take the place of normal established patterns that folks were in.
Excellent. Thank you, Dan. I appreciate it. So I'm going to kind of in respect of everyone's time, I'm going to kind of merge the final two questions here together. We talked a little bit about, you know, your understanding of where each of your states started off pre-pandemic, and then got into a little bit of the challenges that you began to experience and how you began to overcome those challenges. You began to adapt your plans, modify your processes and procedures. And essentially start to evolve based on lessons that you were learning, practices that you begin to develop and share amongst one another. So real briefly, I want to kind of just get your insight on what you feel are probably the most or the significant evolution and improvements within each of your prospective states or across the region that you feel has come out of the COVID-19 response, as well as what you might have on the horizon, what the way forward is for your respective states. So I'll start back actually with Dr. Erickson. How did Oregon evolve, and what's on the horizon for your area?
Thanks. The evolution has been pretty staggering. I agree with what Daniel said at the beginning, where it's sort of hard to remember what it was like before the pandemic started in some ways. A few points. I think the state feels a lot smaller now. I think we've clearly solidified a lot of relationships and ways of communicating, and we're working right now within the state to create something very similar to what Washington has developed, which is a statewide coordinating center for placing patients that will be a little bit more formal. We've also developed some data systems that are essentially a version of what we had before that's hooked up with real-time reporting that automatically pulls information from each hospital's electronic health record to give us a sense for what capacity is looking like in different parts of the state, which I think is really valuable. I do think it's really important to mention that we have taken a really soft approach in Oregon. And I think a lot of that is because, you know, even in the middle of disasters, people will often want to continue doing you know, things rough, largely the same way they have been doing them. And in a lot of ways that makes sense. Those patterns have often evolved for very good reasons. And so our goal is really not to build something to replace, you know, daily operations. It's really just to layer something on top of what generally works pretty well. Just as an example, when different hospital systems report what their census is, you know, one hospital saying they're at 120% of capacity and another hospital saying that they're 150% of capacity, it's really hard to know what that means if you're not in that hospital and actually seeing what happens. So by keeping it about the transfer of an individual patient, I think that helped to ground everybody to what the clear need was, regardless of what you were reporting in terms of your capacity. It was a patient that you were unable to serve. And I think that helped to galvanize a lot of support for the system. Last thing I'll say is, it has been really great to have conversations with both Idaho and Washington through the pandemic. And I have actually personally called the Washington Medical Coordination System about patients in Central Washington who were requesting transfer, where the referring center was requesting transfer into Oregon. And I know that Washington has done the same to us. So a more regional awareness of where capacity is and what the goals are for being able to take care of patients in the most logical ways that ultimately ideally keep patients closest to home has been really valuable. Thanks.
Fantastic. Thank you, Dr. Erickson. Dan, do you have anything further to add for Oregon?
I think for Oregon, Dr. Erickson did a really great job hitting that. I think the only thing as we move forward that is kind of on my mind and something that we've worked on within our four hospitals within the system, but I think there's some statewide work that could be done on this as well is, I think Dr. Erickson maybe even touched on this, it's really how do we keep patients closer to home versus skipping over other facilities to, I think I've grown in my appreciation of the coronary services that OHSU and some of our other larger institutions in the Portland metro area have. If we're filling those beds with patients that could be served in other facilities closer to their home, we're preserving those coronary beds for those patients that really need them, and we're not bottling up that hospital. So I think it's just we have opportunity to continue to create awareness of what services are available across the state and making sure that we're really getting patients to the right level of care and not a higher level of care than what they actually need.
Very good point. Thank you, Dan. I appreciate it. And Christine, how's Idaho evolved and what's on the horizon for your state?
Sure. Thank you. Well, we've evolved a lot, you know, over the course of the several COVID surges that we've had here. We're pretty far into actually a significant surge in the fall of 2020. We became, of course, concerned about whether we had sufficient visibility to do load leveling across facilities in the state, or at least in our region. And at that point in time, we started it just in part of the state, because the need didn't seem to be quite enough to require at that point trying to coordinate patients across southwestern, southeastern, and northern Idaho all at the same time. So we started locally, and I'd say we learned a lot about what capabilities the various hospitals have, and we, I think, developed quite a strong level of collaboration so that facilities were saying, you know, small facilities even were saying, we could take X number of med-surg patients, stable med-surg patients from your facilities, because we came to realize certainly COVID critical care patients need to be in the hospital. Frankly, they need to be in the hospitals where they were, unless there was just no way to expand that kind of capacity for those patients and move people who are more stable to other facilities who potentially had or did have room to take them. And so in that particular surge, we were able to do that fairly effectively and probably didn't have to facilitate nearly as many patient transfers then as we later did when we got to the Delta surge, which was really just a tremendous strain on the facilities across the entire state. And last summer, as we could see that surge starting or coming on, you know, actually at the time we probably thought we were pretty far into it, but it got a lot further after that. We started having our Idaho medical operations coordination cell calls, our mock calls statewide. I think really probably late August that we started doing that. And those scaled up and down with need over time. We were meeting every day, certainly through crisis standards of care and beyond. And through that process, let's say there were in excess of 200 calls among the group. And the purpose there, of course, was to make sure that we had folks who could speak to, nothing is really real time, right? It's always a point in time, but they could provide a more up-to-date point in time picture of what their capacity was, what they're expecting to see over the course of the day, what movements they might need to make if somebody has capacity for them. And also add some color to the data. I think maybe Dr. Erickson mentioned that you look at the numbers on the dashboard, and one person, or maybe it's in conversation, someone saying we're at 120%, someone saying we're at 150%. You know, having this conversation on a daily basis, we can have a better sense of what someone means by that. And we tried to get a little bit more standard in the way we were all using that terminology so that we could understand, you know, if someone had space or no space. And we, of course, had to adapt over time to be able to say what we have in terms of staffed beds and what capacity we would have to expand staffed beds to take on additional patients. So we also, through that process, similar to Oregon, we did continue to use the existing transfer center personnel and operations at the various facilities for, you know, when actual movement needed to occur, so that patients weren't technically transferred through these calls, but people were connected, facilities were connected through these calls with who might be able to help today. And I believe our number was, certainly dozens, I think close to 70 patients who were moved as a result of the activities that were occurring in these calls. And resources were shared across facilities as a result of these calls too. If someone needed ventilators of a particular kind, or someone needed some other kind of resource that they had run out of, you know, without which they couldn't continue to expand the number of patients they were able to care for. So I'd say that was, I think, a real success here in Idaho. I mean, we were in crisis standards of care for a very good reason, and our implementation and the way we used this process resulted in no patient having to be denied a resource as a result of the crisis standards of care, and no one had to be, we didn't have to make any deallocation decisions as a result of crisis standards of care. And I'll say, there were circumstances where one or more facilities were close and were going to have to do that within hours, and another facility stepped up to relieve that pressure so it didn't have to happen. So I'd say, you know, among the lessons learned is we are capable of doing a lot when we put our heads together, and we'll continue, I think, to use this kind of a process if we are in this kind of circumstance again. We did also leverage another tool that the state had in place, this alert sense tool. If someone needed assistance between mock meetings, so they could call a group together. And generally the idea was that we'd pull together the tertiary facilities, because they're likely to be the ones who could help in those circumstances. Those are the facilities we felt were more likely to be able to expand capacity if necessary and take on additional patients from others. I'll stop there because I know we're running low on time.
Thank you, Christine. Appreciate it. And Mark, you're the anchor for today's discussion.
Batting cleanup. No, and I do want to leave folks some time for questions, but we did take this opportunity to expand that DMCC structure concept and really design or create a coordination center initially in Western Washington and then expanding pretty rapidly across statewide that allows a center, again, recognizing people's all the comments that people have made, we did not want to become the state transfer center. So we do part of the education and training and the collaboration that occurred with Department of Health, Washington State Hospital Association, both healthcare coalitions here in Washington to train the facilities regarding the workflow that will that needs to occur utilizing the WMCC as we refer to it. Utilize your own transfer center, your typical transfer processes first. When that doesn't work, call us. And at that point in time, using the available knowledge that we have from situational awareness calls, as well as the data platforms, which I do want to commend Oregon on their data platform. It is significantly better than what we have. And as we've started to have collaborative talks, it's definitely an area that we can learn here in Washington State from Oregon about. Call us. We will, utilizing the data that we have available, find an available resource for you, whether that be because you have too high of capacity or the patient acuity in front of you is beyond your capability to handle. And then that has kind of evolved into the structure that we have. We've taken, I believe, 3,600 or so calls during this during the development of this time. That's evolved to the status that we have now, which is really 24/7 operation that's scalable, that even at baseline, we're available for hospitals to reach out. And it's not done. It still needs work to develop, but it gives us a good jumping off point for what I think the next step really is, which is that all of our region, Oregon, Washington, Idaho, continue this sort of collaborative effort so that we can build on the statewide coordination in each of these three states. And I would, include throughout Region 10 completely to consider interstate patient movement as well through this type of a collaborative effort. So let me stop there because I know we're short on time.
Thank you very much, Mark. Appreciate it. It was a great summary. And I want to thank everybody today for your participation in the panel, for sharing your information, sharing your experiences, and your strategies for moving forward. So thank you all very much for your time today. And with that said, I'm going to turn it back over to Megan to transition us into our final Q&A session for both the panel as well as for the entire webinar for today. So Megan, thank you very much. Back to you.
Thank you so much, Dave. And thank you to all of our panelists and Dave for such a great panel. We're very excited to continue this in the coming months and really appreciate all of your great insight. For the last couple of minutes here, we'll give just a couple minutes for any questions. I know I saw one in the chat and we will get back to you on, Kathy, on your question. We'll use the email you provided at registration to reach back out to you. And then I did see another question in the chat. Looks like it's another grants question. So Amy, we will also get back with you using the email you provided at registration. It looks like we're almost at the top of the hour. I'll leave the line open just for a second here if anybody has any quick questions or comments.
Yeah, this is very kind. I do have a comment. Thanks to the presenters and to Dave for like a really extraordinary presentation. I'm not sure that any of us would have known how important that work that you did and continue to do really is. Many of you probably have already seen it, but the study by NIH showing that 1 in 4 COVID-19 deaths was potentially attributable to hospital strains by surging caseload just reinforces the importance of the work you did. That was a study of data from 558 hospitals. not a small study, the follow-up study to try to figure out, did transport actually make a difference? As in, did it compromise outcomes, so forth? Reinforced, yeah, transport works and it doesn't compromise outcomes. So the work you did, masterful, just masterful. So really applaud it. And it's a really important thing that you did. Let's see, a couple quick thanks beyond our presenters and panelists to all those who have participated today in the meeting. We absolutely invite you to share any stories regarding how you or your members' hospitals are using ASPR funding to make a positive impact on their communities. If you've got a story to share, please fill out the stories from the field submission form or reach out to your FPO for more information. Yeah, Megan just dropped that, the grant information we're gonna try to share in separate communications because I wanna make sure that Jennifer has a chance to weigh in on those responses. Thanks all, it's been a really great webinar and meeting. Thanks all. Megan, anything left?
No, that's it. Thank you all so much. Have a great rest of your day. And I think we can close out.